about the overall social cost, you've got to do something to reduce the incidence of injury. So you do everything from putting a headgear on a kid riding a motorcycle, because he's going to sue the manufacturer, even though he's going 70 when he broke his skull. He's going to sue the bloody manufacturer for it. So you're going to put the burdens on. Why? Because your theory is up front, it costs less to prevent than it does to rehabilitate later. And it usually does, an ounce of prevention sort of thing. And second, the incidence of that cost is on the corporations now, who can then either buy, swallow it or insure for it, where there's a hidden tax. Whereas later, it's on the taxpayer. So Reagan, just as he seems to be limited in how much he can get near, how close he can get to the Social Security system, the security blanket, what they call the security net, safety net. I'm sorry about the security blanket. That was a real Freudian slip. blanket slip, what the hell. And for the same reasons, he can't get very close to the environmental. What he's trying to do, because he's a real ideologue, he's a really dedicated guy, is he's trying to subvert environmental regulation by disordering the administrative process. I consider that unconstitutional. Where he's trying to reverse the spirit and the intent of Congress by the way he appoints and gives rules and regulations to the rules or regulators. I think it's unconstitutional. But he is not confronting Congress in either aspect of the welfare state. So that would be my comparison. Agriculture is losing out, like all areas of traditional regulation are losing out. And we're wiping out middle people and consolidating into more and more concentrated industries in all fields. Agriculture is simply not escaping what is happening in most of the other sectors of the economy. At the end of Ronald Reagan, just as at the end of Charles de Gaulle, we will have a much more concentrated economy. He loves markets, but he's going to get the opposite. A much more concentrated economy than before he went into office. But he's not going to touch the welfare state. There ain't no political market. There's no political advantage to it. That would be my analysis.
Does that follow, Professor Robinson, within your definition of more of the same?
Yes. Generally, we are moving in that direction already, and certainly as far as agriculture is concerned. The other economy is going different directions. Partly, we aren't going towards concentration because we are getting more competition from abroad, and we're moving towards a service economy where a degree of concentration is much less. So the old idea of monopoly capitalism isn't quite the same as it was, and we're not going to get monopoly capitalism in agriculture. We are going to get consolidation in the market.
By the way, one of the theories, one of the great interesting differences between Great Britain's history of attitudes toward monopoly and ours, is the British were always much more involved in international trade, and their feeling, which both parties accepted, was that that's the best antidote to monopoly. If you've got a lot of international trade, you can't really succeed, whether it's cartels or internalized monopolies. It just won't succeed for long. So the British never had the kind of pronounced antitrust movement and antitrust laws that we did. Much more weak and rudimentary. I think what's happening in the United States, so that not all this is bad, if Reagan and others are sincere in their desire for international trade, especially international trade in agricultural products, then we do have an antidote at the level of international trade for whatever market power a concentrated agribusiness would give us. So there's a balance there, and as a result, you can say, beware, but not all of the results of concentration are on the bad side of the ledger. Assuming, especially, a vigorous and less interfered with international trade system. And that's very possible.
And 5 years ago, a lot of people in the United States were concerned that it was not possible for a young person to enter agriculture because the price of land was so high, the price of equipment was so high, etc. I think maybe you're overlooking, maybe not you so much as your colleague, the fact that with the deflation which has taken place in land prices and in equipment values and so on, that it is now possible for the first time really in some time for people to enter agriculture at the commercial scale at a much lower level of investment.
I agree.
Ease of entry will be there.
It is ironic that the very thing that they're most concerned about, this deflating land values out in the Midwest, is the only thing that's going to save the really young farmer with the new entrant. Now, it's the guy that entered 5 years ago that's getting in the neck. But the most recent entrant is going to be better off. In fact, we're still going to write it down further.
Well, let me just ask. I don't have an answer. That's a very good question. I can only answer for the question. What are the facts on this? Since lower land values are meat for anybody. Are the entrants big guys expanding their holdings, or are little guys who work in farming now says, oh boy, I got a chance to go in farming now? I always assume what farmers say themselves is that that's a condition. So I don't know who these new people are who will go in and buy this devalued land and start farming that weren't already farming somewhere. Who are they?
It's a whole host of things, but quite a few of them are going to be fathers that are going to be buying land for their sons and daughters.
But aren't these the same people who are going bankrupt in the farms they got now?
Well,
he's going to go somewhere else and buy them?
I think there's some of that, but you've overstated the degree of bankruptcy. I mean, we're not talking about a wholesale bankruptcy.
Well, that's right. They're salvaging with a sale and not losing everything. That's good. But let me ask the question slightly more directly. Who is buying the land now? The people who are much, much bigger who are adding, or are they other equally middle-sized guys who are buying?
The one who has his debts in order. I mean, a creditor won't loan to somebody who is 70% in debt. And it's obviously those who were not expanding earlier or got the debts in good order. Those are the kind of people who are going to afford to buy. I think that's true. There's no question. But what the bulk of the farm sales are to existing farmers who are expanding. But as Dave says, a lot of them are expanding because their son is coming into the business. So indirectly, it's helping younger farmers.
I'd be very happy for that to be the case. I saw a hand. Come on.
Yes.
My
question, I think, is very simple. In the 1930s, the Farm Federation Bill we discussed, was that composed of farmers or was it composed of politicians?
The question was, the Farm Bureau Federation of the 1930s, was it composed of farmers or of politicians? Sometimes I think it's hard to make that distinction. I'm being caught. It's just that farming has been in politics, it's been politicized for so long that some of the most astute and involved people in politics are people in agriculture, whether they are actually hands-on farmers or have some other direct connection with farming. All I was saying earlier, I'm sure your question jumps off from that, all I was saying earlier is that the American Farm Bureau Federation can be understood only as a response to and as a sponsorship by the national government. It was deliberately, as a matter of policy, sponsored. It was encouraged to be, because that was a form of local participation. It was a way of evading constitutional problems, that they weren't violating interstate commerce rules. And farmers, as well as the farm officials, believed in local participation, just like kids in the 60s believed in local participation. But the actual participants in the Farm Bureau Federation were people who themselves were farmers, or maybe a son of a farmer who decided to spin off and become an administrator, just like workers become union leaders. So they weren't politicians or government officials. It was not a German or Italian type sponsored fascist group. No, this is a bona fide sector organization. It's just that their emergence and their raison d'etre was much more closely tied to ongoing programs than most interest groups you'll find.
So the basis for its actions and policies and formation was reinforcing the existing structures, not
the question on whether, therefore, the reason for their forming was to reinforce existing structures. You're darn right it was. But it wasn't so much a class bias. That is, they weren't just committed to reinforcing the structures of the rich farmers. A lot of people, especially moderate and small farmers, but with some modest amount of education, so they weren't, let's say, Appalachian farmers didn't get much into this. Real dirt farmers, absolute abject poverty farmers, especially blacks, weren't getting much advantage to this. But everybody else except the underclass were. It was not biased in terms just of rich farmers. Now, in the 30s, they got something of an impression of being an upper class group of farmers, first because there was a competitor called the Farmers Organization that asserted representation over farm laborers as well as poor farm operators. So that, by definition, made the Farm Bureau Federation look like it was spokesperson only for the rich. That wasn't quite true. But it also got its reputation from the fact that it was very ambivalent about the price support program. That was out of their control. These were the commodity guys that were running that. And new bureaucrats were running that. The Harry Hopkins guys, the Raymond Moley guys, some of the other brain trust guys. They were in agriculture. They were the biggest fan. Harry Hopkins and Henry Wallace. These were some of the most forward looking. They were then called commies and left wingers in the agriculture department. But these were the ones who wanted to transform agriculture. They also wanted to do it for the purpose of maintaining the existing structure. But the Farm Bureau Federation didn't have any particular influence over there, and many Farm Bureau Federation people were either neutral or antagonistic to the new price support program. They were scared of the size and the bureaucracy, and they were scared of the loss of farm autonomy. And all that was true.
What was the alternative?
The alternative, I assume, is to the expansion of the productivity side. I mean, that would be out of balance. That is, as Professor Robinson said, that would never work by itself, because farmers run themselves out of business by their own productivity.
But the
extension, the kind of extension in 4-H activities that the Farm Bureau Federation was mainly in favor of, was on the productivity side. Now, many of these people had favored dumping over high tariff laws. So that would be the other conclusion. If you want to be strictly in productivity and not worry about controlling the profligate behavior of your individual farmer with artificially high prices, they'll grow more and let you control them. The McNary-Haugen tariff, which was vetoed 3 times in the 1920s, was a product of Farm Bureau Federation-type thinking, the so-called farm block of the 20s, which is what they wanted to do, was to set artificially high prices on these same commodities using a parity principle. And then, since those artificially high prices would encourage our growth and also encourage farmers from abroad to send things over here to get those high prices, what could you do? First, you had to set high tariff law. So you put a tax on incoming products so that they would compete unfavorably with ours. And then all the surplus that you create by farmers growing too much to clear at the market prices, you dump over those walls whatever prices are going. That would be the other way, using the international market as your garbage dump. That would be the only other way to do it, except some balance, as I think it was beautifully put, some balance between the productivity side and what he calls the welfare side. I would call it the balance, or the land use, or the intervention side. I mean, you have very few alternatives. And I gather we agree one of those alternatives is not the market. We'd go crazy if agriculture were back in an unregulated market situation.
The point of my question was how much actual voice the farmers had in developing.
The question was how much voice the farmers had in developing these? I think everything. The rumors among outsiders like myself was that farmers wrote their own ticket. And they have to apologize for what we got. And that doesn't mean every farmer agreed. It wasn't sort of unanimity. That would have to be enforced and artificial. But the general rule of thumb in Congress around Washington from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and into the 60s was that agriculture writes its own ticket. And I can find, I've even got some in print, I can find quotes of Lyndon Johnson's, as late, therefore, as the domestic era of Lyndon Johnson before Vietnam. Let's see, through 1965. I've got good quotations from President Johnson saying, my God, why don't you tell us what they want?
Why are they losing their power now?
Why are they losing their power now? The economic situation has a lot to do with it, and their size, they've been losing population. And these programs, people are thinking, aren't working. I think there's some truth to that. That doesn't mean we can go cold turkey. I don't think that's the implication of anything we've been saying here. So there are all kinds of reasons, including the ideological predisposition of the Reagan administration. So, I mean, I don't think there's any one explanation.
My question is directed toward you, Professor Robinson, and it concerns the remark that Professor Lowy said that the deregulation now is going to save us $10 or $11 billion. Do you agree with this, or are there costs that are going to come up that we're not seeing?
The public cost of agriculture programs are just growing enormously. The question is, will the deregulation, in a sense, save these costs? No, we're going to compromise again. Certainly, Stockman mandated that they cut the program cost, and the proposals that have gone forth under the secretary's name are really proposals of David Stockman. John Block got clobbered, and they aren't really his preferences on proposals. But Stockman says you got to cut the budget, and he's making the agricultural part of that. And the proposal is that you cut expenditures from the current level, which might be $12 or $15 billion, down to $6 to $7 billion. You cut them in half. My guess is that to make farm products competitive, you're going to lower the loan rates, because with the overvalued dollar, we are getting priced out of the market. You're going to lower the loan rates, but you're not going to lower the target prices. The target prices, the difference between the target price and the loan rate, or deficiency payment, we're going to lay a bigger pipeline into the trade.
That's great. I'm glad to have heard that. That gives me something really important to think about. Let me ask.
That's an oversimplification.
Let me ask you a question about that. No, this is fascinating stuff. I'm so glad I'm here. Let me ask you another question about that. What about pick? I mean, the real value varies depending on the actual market price that you use to estimate the value. But won't there be a saving in budgetary terms for what would be the almost absolute cutoff of that's the production products in kind, payments in kind, where they give a farmer in certain products the equivalent of what he will not grow, if you would mind newspeak, 1984 type. And all that is a cost, but won't there be additional savings on top of the actual monetary restrictions, the actual money saved?
Well, if we go back to PIC, but there's no provision for PIC, it's dead politically. So we may back into it
so
again.
So we don't get any budgetary advantage from that now. That won't.
It's passed. I mean, it's we acquired the commodities, and we gave them back to farmers. So the real cost.
There's almost none left to give, anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there will be soon, I think. Now what they want is a PIC program for overseas. I mean, to make them competitive. You sell, the old 2-for-1 sale. We sell them at some price, and then we give the exporters some more commodities to essentially subsidize exports, but we subsidize in kind. So we'll have S and K instead of P and P.
That's sick. It's sick. That's sick instead of pick. That's good.
I keep on trying to remind myself that we're talking about food here also, and I wonder what you think about the effects of this deregulation and such on the production and distribution of food and how this will.
You mean price and availability of food for people who really need the stuff? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah.
Well, I'm in accord with what Professor Robinson said a minute ago, that the food prices are, in a relative, historic and relative terms, very low in the United States and are the envy of the world. I mean, the history of prices, food is very expensive. It represents survival. I think historically, food's been very expensive. And distribution is another part of it. And that's not all, that has nothing to do with what farmers do. In fact, they're more slaves and victims of distribution than they are responsible for it. So much of what people worry about as to price or availability of food is like with the poor characters in Africa, Saharan Africa now. That's the distribution system more than anything else. So I'm not sure, since farmers will make a big point that the cost to them of the loaf of bread is a marginal factor in what you pay for it off the shelf downtown. So I'm not sure that much of what we say here has a short run relevance to the kind of thing that I think is in your mind. Yeah, please.
One more problem. We've run the experiment on what will happen with deregulation, because we're in half of agriculture deregulated already. You got the example from broilers and eggs and fruits and vegetables. More consolidation, larger output, cheap broilers, cheap eggs. It's not a disaster for consumers. It sure is for those who are some producing some of these commodities.
But they have to be big enough.
I agree. And you've got a lot of instability too. And they do have a lot of risks associated.
But mainly, don't mix up food, prices, farmers, and so on, and distribution. They're part of that system. But my God, that's a subject for another time. That's a much different thing altogether.
I'd like to follow up the earlier question on the adverse social costs of the depopulation of rural America, specifically the effect on small towns. Now, we do have a study of rural America here that's applicable. That's at least Goldschmidt's study of Arvin and Danuba in California from the 1940s and 1950s. Two towns virtually identical, except that one had a large concentration of farmers outside, the other had corporate farming outside of it. And city conditions were much better in the one that had a lot of farmers outside of it. What's going to happen to towns like Durand, Wisconsin, Story City, Iowa, Watertown, Minnesota, when they lose 20 to 25% of the farmers that they serve? How will they survive economically?
But maybe you should rephrase it. I don't know. Did everybody hear the question?
The question is, what's going to happen to rural communities when you get consolidation of agriculture, whether you go the way of the famous Goldschmidt study of Danuba and in California, the consequences of concentration and a corporate structure. I don't think you go that way. That's a false analogy, because you aren't going to have corporate agriculture. See, that's California agriculture. It's
historically happened in California for some reasons, but Wisconsin's not going to go towards corporate agriculture. Upstate New York, you are going to see declines of rural communities that are not tied in with part-time farming. There's just no question. The more remote areas, the areas adjacent are going to survive in part because people are going to commute to jobs. They're going to continue in agriculture. You're going to have a million farms which are going to be dependent primarily on off-farm job opportunities that's going to help to sustain rural communities. But commercial agriculture is going to mean loss of sales for some communities. I don't think there's any question what that's going to happen. And Main Street, and one of the things that was pushing the Credit Act was Main Street and the creditors and the machinery dealers. They're really taking it on the chin.
So you're going to see a migration from the small towns to the cities?
Oh yes, you're going to see this. It's a continuing process that's been going on all through my lifetime. I mean, from 6 down to 2 million farmers, there's one thing, you can't go that much lower. You see, I mean, you're asymptotically, you reach a limit. So the adjustment that we're going to make in the next 10 years is much less than we made in the last 20 years. I mean, the big adjustment in agriculture is already over. Right now, it's pretty marginal compared to what we've had over the past 20 or 30 years.
On that same topic, we keep saying that we're not going to true corporate farming, but what in the long run is going to keep us from going to that?
Low returns is going to keep us from going to corporate.
There's just no money in it.
Willing to exploit themselves and work harder for longer hours for lower returns.
Nice to know there's a limit to corporate intrusion, isn't it? Just stay poor and you'll keep the corporations out.
You're right. That's the irony. You said it very well. If we get supports comfortable, then we'll have corporate agriculture. But our policies to protect the family farm, if they were really successful and raised returns, then I think we'd be much more likely to have corporate entry.
And one of the reasons I think, this is very controversial, I'm sure, but my impression is one of the reasons you got more corporate agriculture in California is because it was there by virtue of the government. The government didn't say form a corporation, but the amount of government subsidy, the land grants and the water development and most area, the fertilizer, everything else is so deeply and systematically governmental. And governments prefer to deal with larger numbers of small units. The smaller number of larger units. So, I mean, there's a symbiotic relationship between two big, you know, corporate structures. Government's a corporate structure anyway. So while I'm not the pure laissez-faire type of analyst or ideologue, I do like to recognize certain historic relationships and institutions, and governments tend to prefer bigger and more corporate, stable institutions to deal with. So I think the history of California, I'm glad to say, is unique. People said the only way to understand California is define it as a foreign country, and then you understand it. And in this particular regard, I take solace in your observation that it really is. I think I saw the lady in the blue striped sweater there with her hat. Was it somewhere over there? Didn't I see it? Oh yes, just was right. Yeah.
Do you think the farmers and politicians will adapt regulatory laws and their policies as biotechnology actually transforms from science to a technology that is applying itself to the market? As we're seeing now with the FDA's recent passage that hormones and milk production can now be used, and they estimate that it will increase milk production up to 30% and 25% of the actual cows in America will not be needed anymore.
Surplus cow program.
Right.
You got it. I mean, that's it. And technology just drives it more in that direction, and you then either have to accept the adjustments or bail them out.
But you know, there.
And what we try to do is to do a little of both. We try to ease it by putting in a support program so it doesn't drive the price down, and then you accumulate some surplus, then you can't live with that, so you're forced to make some quotas on production possibly. But in the end, you're not going to prevent it from, if as long as it is economic, prevent it from occurring.
You know, but
it's a rear guard action.
When you project, though, be sure you count numbers. When you don't just say, as the present trend continues, on a matter of biotech. After all, you got the computer, you got several things, and among them, you may be improving the chances of individual autonomous farmers making enough to survive and even to return. There might be a slight return of growth of the very size of farms that are disappearing now. So that sometimes the very variables that you take into account most will surprise you as to the outcomes they'll produce. So it could lead to more corporate farming, as was probably implied in your question, but it could also lead to cottage industry type things that we're now looking at in cities. I mean, the unions and the management are going crazy over the prospect of cottage industry in the needle trades, because the computer is now suddenly making all kinds of things possible that went out of date 50 and 75 years
putting
ago.
Putting out system.
Yeah. So we may very well find an equivalent thing. So be careful. The very things that may lead you to think it's going to be more corporate, wider margin of profit and return, and larger scale possible, could also enable more of a cottage type of industry in agriculture again, too. I wouldn't want to hazard a guess as to what the outcome would be.
There's a question back.
Yeah, way in the back somewhere.
It seems to me that there's a contradiction in saying that you're protected from corporate agriculture occurring on a general scale, and the statement that you're going to have a continuing decline in the number of farms. It seems to me like there is a limit to how much an individual family, the productivity of an individual family. In fact, it seems that at least that with the present unless there's really radical changes in the technology, that you're not going to be able to have a single family managing a large increase in land without hired labor. And what I sort of see could easily happen is that these what are now family farms continue to grow, say double or triple in size, at which point they're all necessarily operating effectively as family-owned corporations, but corporations nonetheless, without providing their own labor, providing the bulk of the labor for the farm, which is the definition, really, of a family farm. It's not so much family ownership, it's family labor that makes a family farm.
There is an increasing proportion of hired labor, but it's still only about 30%, something like that.
So my point is,
but it's the only industry where you got over half the labor force still members of the family. I think we are going to move in the direction towards larger family corporate farms in which they will hire some additional labor.
But can't you make distinctions? Beware not to take the word corporation to mean bigness, remoteness, and impersonality. There is impersonality, after all, corporation is a fictitious person. But nevertheless, if a family incorporates for tax and credit reasons,
and transferring the farm,
yeah, that's right, and estate reasons, damn, terribly important one, that still doesn't put it in the identical category with something else called corporation, which is absentee-owned, remote, and strictly profit margin kind of operation where everybody owns an employee. So just to say corporate, I think, so overstates the case as to make the word corporation almost an inaccuracy. So we have to subdivide this type of corporation versus that one. And if it's a family incorporated, that certainly has a different meaning. It's different, but it also has a meaning different from corporations in the sense of a Wall Street type publicly traded corporation.
The other thing is, with the modern equipment, a man and a son can operate 1,000 acres
with certain commodities. So-called surplus corn.
That's just tremendous.
Maybe just one more, and I think we've about reached the proper time. Go ahead, there in the back.
Could you tell me more about the book? Could you tell me more about the prospect of the U.S. dollar in the international market? I know about the rice market best. I tell you about the international rice market. But until 1975, the U.S. was really looking for the situation of world rice market. And, the main shortage around the world, they try to produce more rice in domestic, field and try to export more. But it didn't work. In 1973, the U.S. had a really big, stop. So they agreed that kind of, systematic and quality. That was actually the land allotment policy, but they quit the policy and they allowed the farmers to decide how much produce. So, to me, the U.S. seems to, in a sense, run away from the world market for some market like rice. So, what's going to be?
afraid I didn't understand the gist of the question. I wish you were closer up, but I just didn't catch, especially the opening, the character of the question. You can if you could.
Well,
if you did,
that's
I'd
it.
Like
the U.S. has become a dominant supplier in rice as well as in wheat and corn. I mean, we're have been in the period of the 1970s, the U.S. share of the world market for all these commodities rose. Became by all odds the OPEC of the grain exporting business, including even rice, even though by world standards we're a small rice producer. We have lost market share in the last 4 or 5 years because our support programs have held prices up and other countries have undercut us and expanded. And we've lost our dominant, well, we're still dominant in wheat and corn, but we've lost market share from as high as 60% down less than 50%. And that's what the Secretary is concerned about, is losing our share of the world market because of overpricing.
Yes,
it's providing a comfortable opportunity for others to sell under.
Oh, that's what you say, but the U.S. was, intended to, be a last resort.
Yes, to supply our last resort, yes.
Well, but now, no.
Still is.
Still is?
Oh, yes.
In the future, the U.S. will continue to kind of, try to play that kind of role?
We're going to continue to be the famine reserve again?
Oh, yes. We are the supplier of last resort. That's what the position we don't want to be in. We'd like to be an aggressive market, but we have large stocks now of rice and wheat. We'll have some increase in stocks of corn. We are the residual supplier to the world and are performing the function by default, not by design, but by default of being the reserve holder, the lender of last resort for the world.
Thank you.